I'd like to be able to buy alcohol here. I don't know. I don't know if it'll be good or bad, but personally, I think it's going to be a good thing.
Western Alaska moves toward more liberal alcohol laws. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 7th of October. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Juneau voters raise the cigarette tax.
Our goal is to meet the CDC requirements of a reduction of under 20% of teen smoking by the year 2010.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com. And by Alaska Communication Systems, converging voice, video, internet, and data applications for business with data transfer speeds up to Gig E. ACS, connecting Alaska companies to each other and the rest of the world.
Alcohol proved more popular than sales taxes in yesterday's local elections. In Kotzebue, a community that permits importation of alcohol for personal use but not sale, a proposal to allow a city-run liquor store or bar has a 36-vote edge out of about 800 ballots cast. But 90 questioned and absentee ballots still need to be counted. Two currently dry villages near Kotzebue held similar votes yesterday. Kiana has voted to go wet, 78-58, and early returns from Selawik indicated a similar trend. And in Bethel, voters have overturned alcohol restrictions in place since 1977. The election results are unofficial, but if they stand, the city will no longer be a local option community and alcohol will be unrestricted. Shane Iverson from member station KYUK in Bethel has the story.
For over 30 years, Bethel has been damp. Alcohol could be imported and consumed, but not bought or sold. But that all changed at the polls on Tuesday when a majority of Bethel voters said yes to Proposition 1. That asked if Bethel should revoke local option. It is currently passing with 53% of the vote. There are still about 160 votes left to be counted, but it would take an overwhelming majority of no votes to change the outcome. Proposition 1 came from a petition drive started by a dozen Bethel residents. Over the past 30 years, similar petitions to make Bethel dry or wet have all failed. But this time, the argument was framed by petition sponsors as a way to get out from under the state restrictions imposed on damp communities, restrictions that were largely put in place after Bethel originally voted to be damp. Petition sponsor Thomas Hawken.
Every time the law has been changed, it puts more restrictions on law-abiding citizens. We never asked to have the limit on the amount we would order. We never asked to have our names put into a database accessible to law enforcement, but not to ourselves.
Those restrictions include a database of all customers that order alcohol from Bethel and monthly limits that set a maximum of 5 cases of beer, 14 bottles of liquor, and about 24 bottles of wine per month. Then this winter, the Palin administration sponsored legislation to cut in half those monthly limits for damp communities like Bethel. That language was eventually erased from a larger bill, but the petition sponsors were already outraged and moving forward. By going from damp to unrestricted, there will be no more limits on alcohol imports, and Bethel businesses will be able to apply for a liquor license. Any license will have to first be approved by the Alcohol Beverage Control Board with input from the Bethel City Council. Sponsors say they would not support a liquor store, but they got votes from people that don't feel the same way. Amy Lish is a Bethel resident that hopes some alcohol sales open up within the city.
I'd like to be able to buy alcohol here. I don't know. I don't know if it'll be good or bad, but personally, I think it's going to be a good thing.
Proposition 1 drew opposition from the largest regional organizations in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. That includes the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation and the Lower Kuskokwim School District. Both boards were concerned that relaxing alcohol restrictions would increase access to booze and lead to more health and safety problems. Lower Kuskokwim School District Board President Richard Curtis lives in the village of Tuksuk Bay. Alcohol is illegal in that village, but bootlegged jugs make their way in through Bethel. Curtis says more booze in Bethel means more booze in the villages.
It will impact families, and that'll impact our school attendance and social problems in the school.
The vote is unofficial and will not be certified until the Bethel City Council meets on Tuesday of next week. Meanwhile, city officials and administration are scrambling to react to Bethel's new status as unrestricted. Local option laws will be lifted in Bethel on November 1st. Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
Municipalities across the state held elections yesterday. In the Mat-Su borough, voters defeated a 3% sales tax property tax cap proposition by a more than 3-to-1 ratio. Fairbanks voters also rejected a 3% sales tax proposal that was tied to a measure to reduce property taxes. The plan could have increased spending on roads, police, and fire protection by $8 million. A proposal in Homer to reinstate a seasonal sales tax during winter months also failed. In Kodiak, a $76 million bond issue to finance expansion and renovation of Kodiak High School was passing, but a $13 million bond to renovate Kodiak School and borough buildings was failing. Sitka voters rejected a pair of ballot propositions that would have improved city roads at a cost of a 0.5% sales tax increase. Ketchikan voted to spend a little over $23 million on a new community swimming pool, and four Southeast communities have okayed the Solid Waste Authority ordinance: Wrangell, Petersburg, Craig, and Thorne Bay. Other communities can also join if they pass similar measures. The authority still needs to organize and find a site and funding before a regional landfill or incinerator can be set up. Voters in Juneau came out 3-2 in favor of a substantial hike in the local excise tax on tobacco. KTOO's Ann Sutton reports.
The levy will go from 30 cents to a dollar on a pack of cigarettes and from 12% to 45% on other tobacco products. Matt Felix, with the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Dependence, says the cost will help deter young people from smoking.
Our goal is to meet the CDC requirements of a reduction of under 20% of teens smoking by the year 2010, and we've already accomplished that. So now what we're really after is lowering the rate of initiation so the next generation is saved from all these diseases that are caused by smoking.
City finance officers estimate the increase could generate an extra $1.2 million in revenues. The Assembly plans to spend the proceeds on health and social service needs related to substance abuse and tobacco use cessation. Voters also agreed to incur almost $12 million in debt for repairs and renovations to Gastineau Elementary School. The project qualifies for 70% state reimbursement, which is subject to an annual appropriation from the legislature.
Happy birthday, dear Bruce.
And Mayor Bruce Botello won a third consecutive term on his 61st birthday. The former state attorney general beat rival and photojournalist Mark Farmer by a margin of almost 3-1. Supporters celebrated his win at Election Central with a birthday cake and song. In Juneau, I'm Ann Sutton.
A runoff will likely decide who the next mayor of the Fairbanks North Star borough will be. It's a close race between the top two vote-getters in yesterday's municipal election, Assemblymembers Luke Hopkins and Tammy Wilson. KYC's Dan Bross reports.
A candidate has to secure 40% of the vote to become Fairbanks borough mayor, and so far Luke Hopkins has 32.36% and Tammy Wilson 31.46%, a difference of just 125 votes. An undetermined number of absentee and questioned ballots are yet to be counted, but likely there's not enough to take either candidate over the 40% threshold. Hopkins and Wilson are borough assembly members on opposite sides of the political spectrum. Wilson says she doesn't plan to do anything different to distinguish herself from her opponent leading up to a runoff. She says her stances on proposed borough pollution controls targeting wood burning and a recently passed plastic bag fee are very clear.
I'm very conservative. I've been against the wood stove issue from the very beginning and the bag tax, so I think those things have already been put out there.
Wilson, who's surprised at her strong showing, credits those she reached in recent weeks campaigning.
The people have been just great. I so believe in door-to-door and the contact that you can make that way, and it's encouraging to know that it works.
Wilson says Fairbanks needs a mayor who will trim the budget and leave business like development of a gas pipeline up to the state. Luke Hopkins says his perspective is different.
You know, Tammy's message, as I've heard it, is, we should have less government, if I understand it. And mine is we have obligations, and I believe that we should be having a government that meets those obligations and takes care of the quality of life as the borough grows and make sure that we're meeting the people's needs.
Hopkins says the candidates' history on the assembly illustrates their divergent takes on the borough's responsibilities.
We have opposite votes on many issues, where I think that, you know, we can expand some of our operations with grant funding and see if it's going to work. I do want to have a lean budget, but as I said earlier, we have obligations to meet.
Hopkins says he'll continue to push hard on local air quality control and getting affordable energy to the borough. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a traveling planetarium lets Unalaska students experience how the stars form.
We were like, we were all screaming because it looked scary.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
This flu season, every Alaskan should roll up their sleeves and fight the flu by making plans to get both the swine flu and regular seasonal flu vaccines. In the meantime, fight the flu by washing your hands often or using a hand sanitizer, coughing into your sleeve or a tissue, and keeping sick people at home. For more information on how to fight the flu, go to pandemicflu.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
There will likely still be an insurance payout for victims of abuse by clergy who filed claims against the Fairbanks Catholic Diocese. That despite a ruling last month that found no evidence of coverage by Continental Insurance Company during a key time span in the 1970s. The diocese cannot locate policy paperwork for the contested period, which could have entitled victims to a payout of anywhere from $8 to $43 million. But an attorney for victims, Ken Rosa, says there are other documented policies that could compensate victims.
There may be many, many, many millions of dollars worth of insurance coverage that may cover all of the claims, and that is just unknown at this time. So I think it's really quite premature for anyone to be discouraged or to be disheartened about this ruling. While we would like to have seen the ruling go a different way, we are not in any way taking this ruling to mean that there will be no recovery for the many, many people who were harmed who filed claims.
The ruling on Continental came last month from a bankruptcy judge presiding over the sorting of Fairbanks Diocese assets for potential inclusion in a compensation package to pay 300 people who filed abuse claims. A lawyer representing the diocese, Casey Nye, agrees there will likely be some insurance money to pay abuse victims. Nye says the church hasn't given up on Continental and will appeal the ruling. He says there is some evidence of coverage, like payments to the company during the contested period. Nye also says secondary damage clauses in policies by several companies could reach back to cover claims of abuse during the contested period.
The definition of a personal injury under those policies includes humiliation, shock, mental anguish. So that would mean that someone who could have been abused in 1974, for example, could have been suffering mental anguish in the 1980s during one of these policy periods and be covered.
Nye says the diocese is waiting to file its appeal of the Continental decision until next week, when the judge is scheduled to preside over a trial on whether the company is due legal expenses for defending itself in the diocese case. He says in the meantime, the diocese legal team is amending the compensation plan to reflect the insurance situation. He says the goal is to have the plan ready for the first of the year, when the diocese is scheduled to emerge from Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Governor Sean Parnell is making no promises to return state commissioners to the capital city. Most heads of state agencies are no longer based in Juneau, and Southeast leaders see it as one more sign of capital creep, the movement of state jobs from Southeast to Anchorage. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Under most governors, State Department commissioners were based in Juneau. There were exceptions, but it was generally assumed they'd live in the seat of state government, along with the governor, other department heads, and during the session, the legislature. That all changed under Governor Sarah Palin, who mostly lived in her Wasilla home and commuted to the governor's office in Anchorage. When she left the job, only 3 of 14 commissioners were headquartered in Juneau. That's still the case, and Governor Sean Parnell has no immediate plans for change.
I'm going to ask them to be based where they think the job can be done from. I'm not going to set a residency requirement on anyone. I'm making those changes based on merit and based on the person and personalities and experience involved. I'm not setting a location requirement.
That means most commissioners will continue to be based in Anchorage, though the governor's boards and commissions director has moved back to Juneau. Parnell, in a recent interview in his Juneau office, says he's sympathetic to concerns about capital creep. Hundreds of jobs at all levels of state government have migrated north, along with workers' families and their paychecks. But Parnell says he's not going to impose what he calls artificial standards on where jobs are located.
To the extent I can hire and find that population pool in Juneau that can do the job that needs to be done in Juneau, it'll get done in Juneau. To the extent that that competency and that experience and the people that are being served are in other places in this state, whether it be Pelican or Wasilla, you know, that's where the job's going to get done.
The movement of state jobs hasn't been just from Juneau to Anchorage. Some positions have shifted from smaller communities to regional hubs as agencies have downsized or centralized. For example, 2 Petersburg social worker positions were supposed to move to Juneau this year. Legislative intervention and community protests kept one job in the smaller community, and the second is being moved to Sitka. Parnell says opportunities need to be created to keep and expand jobs in Alaska's smaller towns, but he wants a more efficient state government, and that could lead to more centralization.
There will be some of that consolidation that you're talking about of services, balanced against the need for accessibility of those services. Underneath it all, it's about creating economies in these smaller communities and creating the climate for jobs in those communities. It's not about artificially preserving, you know, 1 or 2 or 3 jobs. It's about creating those opportunities for those jobs.
State employment is a major economic engine for many Alaska communities. Parnell says he understands that, but has to balance a budget already facing a variety of pressures to grow.
And I see us in a time when we have to be prudent with our state resources. So again, I'm not focused on position count, but I am focused on a sustainable budget. I am focused on making sure that we live within our means, that we have the ability to pay the bills at the end of the day as a state.
He says the cost of keeping state government at its current level is expected to rise 5 to 6% due to inflation this year. In Juneau, I'm Ed Schoenfeld.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve. Litsite Alaska is a web community for families, teachers, librarians, health professionals, and Alaskans of all ages. There are thousands of pages with everything from Alaska's digital archives to kids' games, information about the state's history, culture, narrative, and healing. Teachers love Litsite Alaska. You can discover Litsite Alaska at litsite.org. Litsite Alaska is a project of the University of Alaska Anchorage. This message sponsored by UAA.
The decline of snowshoe hare in the interior is leaving 2 of their primary predators hungry and on the prowl. Alaska Department of Fish and Game spokeswoman Kathy Harms says a recent increase in lynx and fox sightings in the Fairbanks Delta region reflects the start of the downside in the 10-year hare cycle.
We're going to have a year or two here where the hare numbers are going down, but the predator numbers haven't yet, and we'll start to see more of them as they come around looking for food.
Harm says it will take about 5 years for the hare population to totally bottom out. She says fox and lynx populations will respond and eventually decline as well. But in the meantime, the predators will be more common visitors in Fairbanks.
We may see more of them crossing roads. We may see more of them in woods close to town. We may see more of them in housing developments.
Harms says foxes take readily to suburban life, while lynx are more wary. She says both species tend to avoid humans, but people should still be aware.
There could be more dashes across the road causing automobile incidents. I certainly would keep small pets protected, whether it's a cat or a little dog or something like that. I wouldn't let it roam freely.
Harm says small pets are always potential meals for predators, but the risk will likely be heightened over the next couple of years. She says the larger fox and lynx numbers will also present a better than average opportunity for fur trappers. A converted tugboat braved the weather and the waves of the Bering Sea and Bristol Bay to arrive unannounced late last week in Dillingham. KDLG's Mike Mason went aboard the unusual vessel for this story.
The Monnier is an old French military tugboat that was decommissioned and sold back in 2002. It's been retrofitted with masts and sails in an effort to see if a working boat can harness the power of the wind, very much like the old fishing boats that made Bristol Bay famous before the advent of engines. The Monnier left Corsica in late April, headed north to brave the Northeast Passage north of Norway and Russia. The goal was to end up in Japan, but delays forced some changes. Le Monnier translates as the mango tree, and the vessel is captained by Philippe Haché. He decided to forego the trip south from Russia to Japan due to weather and the inability to get the proper paperwork from Russian officials to go ashore periodically. Instead, Haché pointed the Monnier towards Alaska with the intent of wintering here before heading off to another destination sometime next spring. He says the tides in Bristol Bay caught him off guard.
Tide is completely crazy, you know. A few miles from here in the north coast of Russia, there's no tide at all. And here you have 10 meters of tide, you know, and you don't know why. But so in Russia, it's not a problem at all to leave the boat in the water, because when it frees, it doesn't move anymore, you know.
Haché is exploring his options, which includes taking the Monnier to Homer, Seward, King Cove, Sandpoint, Kodiak, or another ice-free port in Alaska. If you go on board the vessel, one of the first things you might notice are the products from Corsica that are shared freely by the captain and crew. Haché says the journey through the Northeast Passage has been underwritten in part by companies in Corsica.
The only thing you can share easily is music, because every part in the world you hear music and you understand, because the language is a very big problem. We saw in Russia, you don't speak Russian, you can't communicate with the people. But with the music, yes. And the other thing is food and drinks. Then it's something universal also.
Haché and his crew basically had two big goals in mind for their journey. First, to actually complete the journey through the Northeast Passage and become one of just a handful of vessels to complete such a journey. Haché says the second goal was to test the ability to use sails on a working boat to conserve on fuel.
And the other thing is meeting people. because when you arrive with such a boat, such a different boat, most of the people, they look at the boat and you can enter in contact very easily with them. And that's an important thing.
One of the crew members on board the Monnier is Judith Pozzoli, who's been working on the project for over a year. She says the captain and crew had a good feeling about Dillingham when they saw it on the map.
And we had our first American burger. For us, it was great. And to see how... We are very surprised to see so many friendly people, because in Russia it was very limited, our contact with people, because the Russians were not allowed to come on board. So it was a long time ago since we had people on board.
Another of the people on board the Monnier is travel writer Karen Hewitt, who is assisting in the effort to document the journey through the Northeast Passage. She says the ultimate goal is to publish a book that mixes adventure with the love of food that is shared by all of the crew members on board the vessel.
And I think this good cook, this good cuisine, was a very important factor everything went all right between us, humanly.
It's unclear where the Monnier is headed, but the vessel successfully left the Dillingham Harbor on Monday afternoon's high tide, headed for ports south along the Alaska Peninsula and perhaps even into the Gulf of Alaska. Captain Haché says he intends to winter the vessel in Alaska with the intent of possibly challenging the fabled Northwest Passage next year. So if you see a tugboat equipped with sailing masts pull into your port in the next few weeks, don't hesitate to ask permission to go on board and visit with a dedicated crew that braved the Arctic with good food good drink, and good cheer. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
Students in Unalaska saw the galaxy from a whole new perspective recently, from the inside of a giant inflatable dome. KUCB's Ann Hillman joined their journey into space.
A group of fifth graders gasps at the quickly changing images of the night sky. A giant air blower hums in the background. They're sitting inside of a portable, inflatable planetarium.
We saw stars, we saw Jupiter, we saw Mars, we saw the sun, we saw our planet.
Kayla Lopez was duly impressed by the star-covered dome, but her classmate, Trey Henning, was still thinking about the lesson he saw the evening before at the community presentation.
We asked how the stars were formed, and, like, she told us, and, like, it looked like germs, but it was, like, black and light, and, like, there was cloudy, and it looked like the sun was coming towards us, so we were like, we were all screaming because it looked scary, and then, yeah.
The traveling planetarium is used to teach the basics to younger children, like why we have seasons and why days last as long as they do, and more complex ideas to older students. Roger Topp, a new media producer from the University of Alaska Museum of the North, shows a group of high schoolers a model of the Big Bang.
So the Big Bang happened at one point in space and at all points in space, because space was defined by nothing at the time. And all this matter spewed out of the Big Bang, elementary particles that glom together and over a long, long time, 4 to 5 billion years.
Student Katie Warren says the experience gave her a new perspective on space and the night sky.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it was able to show you, like, days ahead of what you would be able to see, and really it came together instead of just watching it every night for yourself, especially because you actually got to see without any clouds or anything, so that was awesome.
The entire setup, including the giant fabric dome that folds down into a duffel bag, the planetarium software that's tailored to Alaska's unique night sky, and the fisheye lens projector, belongs to UAF's Museum of the North. Museum educator Jennifer Arsenault says they're using a NASA grant to bring it to communities around the state to supplement science education.
You know, it's a great immersive environment. Just the very going inside of the dome is exciting, and I think you could talk about almost anything and it would be memorable because you're in this neat environment. But you can certainly do things in a planetarium that you can't do on a regular projector or in class, as far as really illustrating concepts in a way that they make sense, because you can set stars in motion, you can look at the planets from above, you know, you're not just showing a static picture.
Arsenault says they collaborate with scientists to make sure they're giving accurate information, and with cultural leaders to incorporate Alaska-specific stories about constellations and other stars. They brought the planetarium to Unalaska as part of the Museums Alaska annual conference and will be touring other parts of the state throughout the school year. In Unalaska, I'm Ann Hillman.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Shane Iverson in Bethel, Ed Schoenfeld and Ann Sutton in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Mike Mason in Dillingham, and Ann Hillman in Unalaska. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Doyon Limited, based in Alaska's interior, growing across the nation. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com.
And by
BP, teaming up with Alaskans since statehood and together looking toward a bright future.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.